Hello, everybody. Welcome to Grounded with Earth Optics. My name is Gunnar Bodvarsson, and I'm joined with Piper Smith and Lars Dierud, our CEO. I'd like to give a brief introduction of myself before we get started here. Like I said, my name is Gunnar. I work as our strategic operations specialist. It's kind of a cross-divisional position between the sales department and operations department. Piper, I'll pass it on over to you to give a brief introduction.
Right. I like your mic, Gunnar. Hello. I am Piper Smith. I'm our partner success director. So what does that mean? I help get our partners on the ground and running with our technology, our sensor suite, so they can go out, soil sample, and see soil differently. I've been with the company for about 2 years. I'm based out of Fort Myers, Florida. Gunnar, where are you from?
I am based out of Rochester, Minnesota.
Awesome. We're a pretty spread out team. I'll pass it over to Lars. Why don't you tell us where you're calling in from?
Yeah, hey, Piper. Hey, Gunnar. Thanks for having me. I'm at our office in Arlington, Virginia right now. I've got the beautiful Earth Optics logo behind me.
Awesome. Is that a living wall right there, or is that faux?
It's not faux, and it's not living. It was a team-building project from several years ago when we moved into the office, so they're all previously alive plants that are now dried up.
There we go. That's close enough. Awesome. Well, let's get started here. Lars, if you could please give a brief introduction of Earth Optics. What is Earth Optics and what do we do?
Yeah, Earth Optics is a soil mapping company. And I sometimes like to say with an emphasis on mapping. So one of the problems we were trying to solve from really day one is how variable soil is and how that makes it difficult to measure and quantify across almost anything that you're trying to accomplish. The kind of analogy I tell for people who don't, work on farms, work on ranches, is anyone's got a lawn will kind of recognize how variable soil is just by looking at, you've got little bright green tufts of grass that are growing way faster than other areas. You've got a dog, that's often where the dog pooped at some point in time previously. But even if you do move just 10 feet away, you might have completely different like clay or sand percentage content, but also guaranteed a completely different microbiome. And so that fact has made it difficult to measure at really high resolution and an actionable resolution for many farmers and ranchers and other applications around soil, because the way we historically measured soil was to take soil samples, send them to a lab, and get a test out. Now you know a lot of information, but only about the very specific areas where you pulled that soil sample. And so we wanted to make soil information a high resolution affair, not something that's just spot sampled. And so we've built a platform that involves proximal sensors, we call them. So these are sensors on ATVs. They're not satellites, they're not airplanes, but they're sensors that drive very close to the ground, but they don't touch it. And those collect a bunch of high resolution information for us on what's going on down to several feet in the soil. And then we can use machine learning to correlate the soil samples we do take with those sensor data sets. And we do include satellite data as well, but the ATV mounted sensors are very critical. We bring that all together using machine learning to make really high resolution maps of whatever you sampled and tested the soil for. One of the key benefits is you now can take far fewer samples, and so the cost can be significantly lower, but the accuracy is often five times higher than you would get from a similar number of samples alone.
That's awesome. No, thank you for that. Now, you mentioned there that we drive with our sensors over the ground and they read the soil. How does that work exactly? Does it literally read the soil, or is it collecting some other form of data?
Yeah, so we use two types of sensors today. We're constantly testing new sensors. I can talk about some of the latest ones we're testing and looking to incorporate into our system. So we don't make the sensors we use. We're testing sensors that often come from other industries. The two we've standardized around today are electromagnetic induction. It's kind of like a metal detector, albeit a pretty expensive metal detector. But it works the same way a metal detector, and I can talk more about that. Then we also use a ground penetrating radar, which does kind of what it sounds like. It's a radar that measures, that bounces radio waves into the ground and measures reflections from various things inside the soil. We've been using those for years. We've recently started testing passive gamma radiation, which is a really interesting tool set. We really like some of the initial data we're getting back from it. So are expecting to include that in our, kind of next generation of the ground owl.
Awesome.
Let me get it straight. We're taking on the ground measurements. We're going out to the field. We're taking traditional soil samples. We're combining that with this, high-tech sensor suite, and we're throwing it all into a mixing pot to get the deepest insight on the field level, what's going on, and then mapping that out.
Absolutely. And the key is the resolution, right? So we produce a soil estimate, whether it's carbon or fertility or compaction, every 10 meters, about every 30 feet, about the distance to a first down marker on football. That's the size of our pixel. And historically on like a 100-acre field, at best, you might be taking 40 samples. And so we're really, you know, going from 40 measurements on a field to hundreds of thousands of measurements on the field. And so it's really about resolution kind of in our view.
Yeah, thanks for highlighting what exactly high res means in terms of size, because I think it's hard. I don't know if we're at the point in this podcast where we pop images up, but it'd be nice to see one of those high res maps.
Definitely.
I think we have to do that now.
Yeah, we have to.
Now, Lars, you said that it, you know, we're essentially collecting, you know, exponentially more data points. What does that mean for, you know, any farmer or rancher? What sort of value does that bring to them?
Yeah, on the agronomic side, so our data products are used for both agronomic decision making, but also we do a lot of carbon measurement. So we're trying to quantify carbon, and resolution is helpful for both those use cases. On the agronomy side, for a farmer, the number one is they're making fertilizer decisions, and so they're going to be spreading fertilizer based upon where it's needed. And if you've got really low resolution information, that means a lot of areas of the field you're going to be applying too much fertilizer, or in some cases too little. And so the goal is to provide the right amount of fertilizer. We want to avoid too much fertilizer and have excess runoff and, quite frankly, wasted money. But we also don't want to have areas of the field that are, you know, fertility limited and you're losing yield and plant growth potential. And so increasing that resolution can, you know, usually translate to several tens of dollars of cost savings, either on applied fertilizer or on lost yield. So anywhere from like $20, $50, $60 on your average use case, going from what is a traditional 2.5 acre grid to something like we're producing. On the carbon side, that can often mean several percentage points of better margin of error. And so, you know, every time you're trying to quantify something, you're going to have a margin of error. We all see like election polls that are in the news, and they always quote a margin of error plus or minus like 4%. And for election polls and polls of soil, the more measurements you take, the lower your margin of error is. And so just like you might see for the presidential election, a presidential poll with plus or minus 4% error, we have that same type of error on when we're trying to say, hey, this field or this ranch has 111,000 tons of carbon, plus or minus, you know, 1, 2, 3%. And so our higher resolution, because soil is so variable, helps us translate into much lower margin of error for those quantifications.
Okay, back up. So we not only do agronomy, we're mapping, we're looking at fertility, we're looking at soil health from an agronomist lens, we're also in the carbon space, right? And I think we could do a whole podcast on agronomy and how we like help there, what insights we can provide. But I think for today's call, we really want to dig into soil carbon, the details around soil carbon. Earth Optics sounds awesome. We are awesome. We do a lot of incredible mapping, but let's like go down this path of soil carbon.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the reasons why, I mean, one of the key reason why we do soil carbon is, like I said, we're a soil mapping company. So we really have the vision of being able to measure everything anyone cares about within soil. And obviously carbon is one of the things that are really important, to a number of stakeholders, and it's, soil carbon industry has been growing rapidly over the last few years. And so we're excited to be a part of it, but yeah, happy to jump in all sorts of more details around soil carbon.
Why don't you just start with what is soil carbon?
That's a great question, Piper. I could also start with one of the reasons why we're so excited about soil carbon. I think many of us truly believe that soil is our solution to climate change, and I'm not even trying to be hyperbolic. It is that we believe that there's enough carbon storage capacity in the soil to completely reverse all of the net human emissions over the last, you know, 50, 60 years. So reversing all the carbon out of the atmosphere through the burning of petroleum products. And so I'll just start at a little bit of the beginning. So all plants are made out of carbon, right? So plants are built and their roots are built from carbon. And so every, you know, continuously carbon is being drawn out of the atmosphere to construct plants. And so that's how you build a plant, is it pulls carbon out of the atmosphere to actually build the structure that you see. So all that carbon comes from the atmosphere. The nutrients that help with photosynthesis come from the ground, but the actual structure of the plant is almost exclusively made out of atmospheric carbon. So every year you get a constant respiration of carbon from the soil to the atmosphere and back and forth again. And just kind of put it in perspective, like the magnitude of that exchange and respiration between the atmosphere and the soil. The soil contains at any moment in time in the top like 3 feet of soil or top 1 meter, 3 times more carbon than is contained in all the atmosphere. And in that same 3 feet of soil, you have five times more carbon than is contained in all the plants and trees on the surface of the earth. So you see all the carbon on, from plants and trees, but we don't see it in the soil that much. But anyone who's ever bought like a bag of potting soil, you've seen how black it is compared to like your regular dirt. That black is carbon. Black organic material, organic matter in soil is typically black and dark. So with more organic matter, it tends to be black than soil.
Can you repeat those stats one more time? Because those are pretty powerful statements.
Yeah, I mean, just that top 3 feet of soil, three times more carbon than the entire atmosphere, and five times more carbon than all the plants and trees on the surface of the earth. And the level of kind of exchange between the atmosphere and the soil. First, once you kind of hear those numbers of like three and five times more, it's very clear that carbon is stored in the soil or in the atmosphere, and plants are the way it kind of exchanges between those two storage locations. And the level of that exchange is a lot larger than I think most people actually realize. And so every year, all the humans on the surface of the planet are burning 18 to 20 billion tons of carbon in the form of fossil fuels. The atmosphere tends to go up about 8 or 9 tons. And so around 10 of those tons that we burn actually don't show up in the atmosphere. And a great question is like, well, where does it go? Half of the carbon that we're burning ends up back into the terrestrial biosphere, into the ocean biosphere, and is ultimately stored long-term in the soil. And so the amount of exchange compared to that 20 billion tons we burn is you've got about 450 billion tons that are respirating out of the soil every year as plants decay. The microbes eat them and they emit carbon dioxide. And then you actually have about 455 billion tons that go out of the atmosphere through new plant construction and new root construction every single year. So there's actually a net already of about 5 billion tons.
So the plants are pulling 455 billion tons of carbon out of the atmosphere each year. And then how much
they're emitting about 450. So there's a million tons that actually go downward, ultimately into the soil and all the plants on the surface.
So they're doing some heavy lifting. They're taking about 5 billion tons out of the atmosphere each year already, just as it is. And so it's not so much like when we say save the rainforest, yes, save the trees, but it's really the soil that those trees are sitting on top of and the work that they're doing converting that atmosphere carbon into soil carbon.
The new net carbon is coming from new plant growth and not just the existing plants that are there. I mean, don't get me wrong, trees store a lot of carbon above ground, but it's a tiny fraction compared to what's stored below ground. And so, you know, it's a tragedy to burn down any forest. However, the constant reduction of carbon is coming from the constant growth. And so you've got storage of trees, and so you burn them, you've lost all that carbon. And so for the rainforest, it's going to be a decent amount. It's like 20 tons per acre. But in most rainforests or even farm soils, you probably have about 50 to 100 tons that are being stored at any moment underground. But what matters long-term is how much continual extraction that acre is taken out of the atmosphere and adding to the soil. That's what really counts long-term. Because one of the things that got me fascinated about like soil carbon and how little we actually know about how this whole thing works on a global scale is like the first time I found out, because I'm not like a soil scientist, I'm not an ecologist, but I was working on a carbon monitoring mission and helping the scientists and engineers design the whole program. I'm like, wait a second, let me get this straight. So there's 5 billion tons of carbon that go into the like terrestrial biosphere everywhere or every year. And like, yes, but where is it going? Like, well, you know, plants grow, blah, 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 carbon net. Like, yeah, but like, where is it happening? All over the place. We don't know exactly where. I was like, well, shouldn't we? So a big part of what we're doing is like trying to answer that question, like, where is the carbon going? There's some areas where we're losing carbon, some areas where we're gaining it. I think we really want to know where are we gaining it and why, and where are we losing it and why, and what can humans do with their management to make it be more the one than the other.
It's amazing. Sure. So, Lars, you mentioned that, you know, you're not a soil scientist by trade and you know, you relatively recently became interested in this. So what were you doing before this?
Yeah, so before Earth Optics, I was working at a company called Eagleview that had bought my last company. So Eagleview is the largest aerial imaging company in North America. So I worked for them for 3 years, first running R&D, and then I moved over to run corporate development, which is looking at different companies to acquire and things like that. So I had a great time there. I was there for 3 years, and that was after running a company called OmniEarth for 3 years prior to that.
Awesome. So then
I was there with Lars for a few pieces of those puzzles.
That's where I met Piper for the first time.
We
were building out a California office, and so interviewing local folks in our brand new office in Orange County, California. And Piper was one of the candidates. And I think I told you at the time too, like, we can stop the interview process. We found our person.
And I've told Lars this story, but I actually got into a car accident on the way to that interview, and somehow he still hired me, and that's how we're all here today.
Funny how that works. So Lars, could we go even a step further back? You know, what did you study when you were in college, and where did you go to college?
I went to college at Augsburg. Augsburg, it's not called Augsburg University. It's called Augsburg College at the time. It's a little Norwegian Lutheran school in downtown Minneapolis. I studied physics and Norwegian while I was there.
That's amazing. Well, I went to also a small Norwegian liberal arts college in Minnesota called St. Olaf College, where I also studied Norwegian, but I did not study the other same subjects as you. What path did you go down after college?
I went on to graduate school. I went into a field called space physics, which is a fairly newish field as most fields go. Like, the field of physics has been around for like 800 or 700 years, and like other fields that are somewhat youngish, like psychology, have only been around for 70, but space physics has actually only been around since the start of the space era. So back in the, starting in the late 40s and 50s, when we started sending things and then ultimately humans to space, it occurred to somebody like, hey, we should probably know like what's going on in this place near the Earth that we call space. It's not completely empty. What's actually happening there? So the field of space physics was kind of fun to understand the near Earth space environment. And that typically includes like everything above like 60 miles from the surface of the Earth, but also includes all the planetary environments and the solar Earth system. So awesome. If everyone saw like a lot of the aurora that you could see across the United States last week, even right a week and a half ago, that's space physics. So the people who studied, I studied space the aurora for probably around 10 years of my life.
Oh, that's amazing. I'm sure that took you to some pretty cool places. Have you worked elsewhere outside of the U.S.?
Yeah, absolutely. I've worked in lived and worked in Norway for many years, first as a graduate student and as a visiting scientist. I did a lot of work at the Arecibo Observatory. So if anyone seen Contact or GoldenEye, which increasingly are older movies these days, unfortunately, the observatory is decommissioned a few years ago after Hurricane Maria. But, awesome engineering structure in the middle of the jungle and the mountains in Puerto Rico. So I used to do a lot of work there. I did use radars to study very small meteors. I've had the good fortune of traveling all the way from Arctic Scandinavian Svalbard at the poles to go study the Norway to study little meteors in Puerto Rico and South America. So it was certainly a fun gig for being able to travel the world and see some cool stuff.
Awesome. Yeah, that's amazing. It sounds like you've traveled all over and you've kind of studied space and time. And since then, you've kind of grounded yourself studying soil carbon a little bit more. I'd love to ask you what really excites you about this growing world of soil carbon?
Yeah, I mean, I think to me, I'm just fascinated with the whole concept of like, as I've dug in more to like, what are the solutions to climate change? And like, realistic, what are the solutions, that, especially the ones that don't, I'm not going to make much of a contribution to like inventing a new electric car or whatnot. So those things are going to go on its own pathway. But I think soil, and particularly food, which is obviously everything that we eat, is sourced to soil at some point in time, whether we're eating, vegetables or grains directly, or whether those, that food is being used or grass ends are being used to raise protein. But currently, I think what's so unique about the food industry and as it relates to soil and climate is right now, I think we estimate that our food production systems account for about 36%, of global emissions. But what's different from that to all the other industries is every single other industry only emits carbon. They don't like sequester carbon. The unique thing about food is we actually can sequester carbon. So all our food and fiber production can sequester carbon. Just like we talked about, like at the global net, there's 5 tons being sequestered every year. Some of it is on lands that humans manage. Some of it is on lands that humans do not. And Mother Nature is just kind of doing it for us. To put in perspective, scientists now believe that 51% of the Earth's terrestrial surface area is now managed by humans, as you know, in our forests, our grazing lands, certainly much less a degree row crop. But we're now the majority shareholders of the Earth. And so we're kind of responsible, in my view, for what happens there. And our food production systems have this awesome potential that even though they're emitting 36% of emissions today, they could be net positive, in my view. We can, as we learn how to manage soils on our working lands in a carbon positive way, we could turn that 36%, which is already a net, right? It's a combination of some food is produced carbon positive, a bunch of it's produced carbon negative, and it nets out to a 36% factor emission for all global emissions. And so it's a pretty awesome opportunity that I think we have in food and fiber production to go from being 36% of the problem to potentially 100% of the solution. Like, as soon as I started like grasping some of those numbers, I'm like, why is this not what everyone's working on? Like, how is this not like, and I think part of the reason is it's kind of confusing and complicated for a lot of people. So hopefully part of, you know, podcasts and things like this is to start making a little less confusing and complicated for folks to understand that what a big possibility and opportunity soil carbon storage is. And then, you know, the other side of that 36% that I'm super fascinated in is like, I think most people are aware of their transportation decisions and how that influences climate, right? People try to drive more fuel efficient cars or buy electric cars these days or be mindful of air travel. And so I think we're all like somewhat aware of our transportation decision making and that impact on climate. Like when I buy a United plane ticket, it's like right on the bottom how many like pounds of CO2 I'm responsible for as part of that ticket purchase. So I think there's a lot of awareness on transportation. There's like almost zero awareness on the food side. But because of that massive variability where some food products are produced carbon positive and majority are produced carbon negative, but you would have no idea going to the grocery store, right? Like, so actually it's not transportation. It's our food decisions that most, certainly American and Western consumers, that's the biggest impact we're having on climate change one way or the other is when we make a decision at the grocery store. But the worst part about it is we have no idea when we choose a particular item at the grocery store, whether it's we're making a carbon positive contribution or a carbon negative contribution. And I think a huge part about why we're trying to measure soils is so we can start making informed decisions around food. And I think most consumers would want to make a carbon positive choice if they had the option, if they knew that they could.
Okay. When you say carbon positive, define carbon positive versus carbon negative.
Yeah. There's no industry set terms on this. So I think, right. I think the industry is kind of leaning towards carbon positive. So everyone knows what carbon neutral is. And so like the production of a product has neither added nor removed carbon from the atmosphere. And so I think the idea of carbon positive is that the production of this product has actually removed carbon from the atmosphere. And so there's a number of products and some that we're working with today where we're helping make measurements and do all the calculations and analysis show like, hey, the actual production of this product, because of the massive soil carbon contributions their production systems are making, you can actually get a net positive product out of the whole situation.
All right. Well, I got a true or false question for you, Lars. Is it true or false, it is very easy to measure carbon in the soil?
False.
False. All right. Well, why is that? Is it because of the techniques involved? Is it because carbon's always moving? What's kind of the underlying reason why it's difficult to measure?
Yeah, I think it starts with the carbon's changing as a function of time significantly. Like I talked about those, you know, 550 billion tons globally are going in and out of the terrestrial ecosystem every day. But it's the last point is that spatial variability, right? Like you can go measure soil carbon in one location. It might be say 3% of the soil content is made out of carbon. And you go, you know, a mere like 50 or 100 feet away and it could be 2, it could be 4. And so capturing both that variability in time, but more importantly, that spatial variability to ensure you get an accurate quantification. Because the kind of changes we're looking to see in terms of like carbon positive food production, they're often, you know, a few part in a thousand change, right? So less than 1%. And so I think scientists, just to compare that to like that goal of being like overall climate neutral, a couple of decades ago, a handful of scientists calculated like, hey, if we just raise soil carbon values on global working lands, 4 parts in 1,000, so 0.4% every year, that would completely counteract all human emissions. And that's not like, that doesn't feel like a crazy number to me. Like that seems doable, you know, 0.4% annually increase in carbon. Like we can probably figure out how to do that. But the, you know, then on the other side, that's a pretty small change, 0.4%. And so what does it take to actually quantify changes that are, you know, year over year that tiny on something that's constantly changing and highly variable, like as a function of location?
Yeah, that's amazing. Well, so, you know, something you just said recently was, you know, humans are now the major stakeholders in how carbon moves throughout the world. And that we control, you know, essentially at this point, the entire, or not the entirety of, but the majority of the land in the world. I myself am not a landowner. So who is really responsible for, you know, this land? And then on top of that, who has the power to sequester carbon within that land?
I mean, in principle, I think we're now learning techniques. It's not always going to be the same technique globally, but we're now learning techniques that can work on all different types of working lands. So there's you know, techniques like regenerative agriculture for row crop, where you know, the application of cover crops, minimizing tillage. There's new biological amendments that are showing a lot of promise for enhancing carbon soil storage. So we're learning on the grazing side. We're seeing that, you know, intensive rotational grazing can be very effective. And so I think there's techniques for every type of land management, whether it's forestry, grazing, row crop, permanent crops like oranges and almonds. I think where there's more and more techniques that we're identifying that, you know, can work on all these type of food and fiber production systems. And it's about finding out which one of these techniques are working on your particular acre. So anyone who's operating, you know, ultimately anyone who's owning and or operating working lands, whether it's forests, grasslands, row crop or permanent crops, I think it's an opportunity to be a contributor to, you know, carbon positive production. And so it's just about learning what works for you on those, on your land and your climate, and working to implement that.
Oh, that's amazing. So yeah, it sounds like the commonality there is really any agricultural producer who is working their land has potential to sequester carbon, draw down more carbon into their soil, and hopefully retain it there. And of course, you know, the overarching benefit is mitigating climate change. But what other benefits or reasons would, you know, a farmer or rancher want to either make a practice change or pay for someone to measure the sequestered carbon in their soil? What benefits are there?
Yeah, I mean, one is just the traditional benefits of healthier soils. And so more carbon in the soil means more organic material, usually better, almost always better water filtration, better water retention, more drought resilience. You know, thinking back to your potting soil that you buy at the store, one of the, you know, attributes of that potting soil is it holds moisture for a long time. You water your plants once a week, and they're probably still somewhat moist a few days later. And so high organic matter content acts like a sponge and can really hold water closer to the root a lot longer than low organic content soils. So that's obviously better for yields, better for, you know, less fertilizer application, less need for irrigation when that applies. So usually you're going to get a lowering of your cost input as it relates to fertilizer or irrigation. So that's, you know, farmers have known that forever. That's not new. They've been looking at their organic matter content and trying to see how they're doing there for a while. Lately, there's a growing number of programs for carbon credit generation, and there's two kinds. There's carbon inset, where you're actually staying within the supply chain. So say you're producing corn, you're selling that corn to someone who's making food or fuel out of it, and they're accounting for their carbon and their supply chain. And so often they're going to provide a payment for low carbon intensity corn. And the same goes with all other types of food and fiber production. That's for inset programs. But there's also offset programs where you've got a company like Microsoft, excuse me, or Shell or Exxon, where they're an inherent part of their business is emissions. That's really difficult for them to get rid of. Oil companies are a great example. It's really hard. It's impossible for an oil company to get rid of their emissions. So they have to look for other sources to work to offset that if they want to be, as an industry, carbon neutral. And so those are called offset credits. And that's another opportunity for many landowners and operators to be able to create carbon credits on their working lands and sell them to these offset markets and offset buyers.
It sounds like the offset, both markets, but it sounds like it's an incentivizing growers to make changes that sequester carbon in their land, rewarding them, providing an extra revenue stream while kind of solving this question of how do we pull carbon out of the atmosphere? How do
Absolutely. Yeah, there's some, like I said, obvious inherent benefits to, you know, increasing your organic matter in your soil, but these new programs are providing a pretty, you know, a pretty great financial incentive to do so as well.
Well, change is hard, I think, for anybody, especially change in, you know, a system that's been operating with year over year efficiency gains. You know, agriculture has gotten more efficient over time. We've seen that across the board. And so I think probably people are asking, why should I change?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, and some of these changes, none of them are guaranteed. Like I said, what's really necessary is figuring out what's working for you, what's going to work for you on your particular acre and your climate. And so that process can add risk for growers and farmers and ranchers. It can, you know, it might reduce near-term their revenue, right? Because you're now just not trying to optimize for yield and production. You're trying to optimize for carbon and yield and production. And so it creates financial risk and financial uncertainty. I think the addition of these programs help create a sufficient financial incentives to make some of those changes and get over some of those risk and uncertainty humps for a lot of folks. And so the more those payments can go up, the higher value that carbon, you know, a ton of carbon can garner in the marketplace is always going to help, I think, adoption.
Yeah.
That's amazing. What, you know, so we've talked about either adopting or changing kind of your agricultural practices to sequester more carbon. So that kind of suggests that, you know, either status quo or historical practices have resulted in carbon entering the atmosphere. Is that the case? And you know, how has carbon, more carbon gotten into the atmosphere in the context of agriculture and practices?
Yeah, I think scientists have estimated that the numbers are, you know, globally it's hard to get at exact numbers, but there's been a number of studies trying to estimate the total loss of soil carbon over the course of you know, the increase in industrial farming over the last, you know, 15, 80 years. In general, I think then the numbers kind of settle in around like a total of 165 billion tons of carbon. And to note, not tons of CO2, but tons of carbon have been evaporated, I mean, are estimated to have been evaporated from global agricultural lands. About half of that number, half of that 165 billion tons is believed could be relatively straightforwardly returned to the soil. The other half is going to be a real challenge because it came from draining. We did a lot of swamp draining globally over the last 50 years, and swamps hold a tremendous amount of carbon. Usually, you know, swamp carbon percentages are like 15%, and a typical like prairie soil might be like 5 or 6%. So, you know, you're never going to get back up to 15% unless you return it to its natural swamp. Swampy says, but the other 60, you know, the other half of 165, about 80 billion tons could be, if we just brought those soils up to their historical levels of soil carbon concentration, that'd be about, you know, 85 billion tons of carbon, which, you know, hating to do math live, to calculate tons of CO2, which is what everybody usually talks in, except for scientists. It's eight divided by three. So I think it's like 3 1/3 or something like that. So it's like 250 billion tons of CO2 equivalent just in that, you know, somewhat straightforward to return. So that's, you know, that's a pretty big number. That's about half of all the emissions that humans have put into the atmosphere throughout history.
There's someone else I'd trust more to do math live, I think, Lars, than you.
As long as it's approximate math.
So we've talked a lot about carbon, a lot about the benefits of soil carbon, how we see it in kind of a global scale, and the part or the role that agriculture plays in that. But let's shift gears here for a second back to kind of agronomy. And like, what do you think from your perspective is the biggest opportunity that farmers have today with Earth Optics in terms of agronomics?
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of things. We talked about the benefits of higher resolution fertility measurements and being able to be more efficient with fertility applications. One of the things we didn't talk about is, you know, our goal at Earth Optics is to be able to, you know, digitally map all soil attributes. And one of that is physical attributes. In fact, our first product is called TillMapper, and it measures soil compaction at every inch going all the way down to 18 inches. And that's used for a number of applications. It allows farmers to be more prescriptive with their tillage to allow them to target a more specific depth when they do till, but also allows them to avoid areas that aren't going to benefit from tillage. And so farmers are well aware of lost yield due to compaction. I think there's estimates that compaction accounts for upwards of $10 billion of lost yield in the U.S. alone every year. So being able to identify areas of your field that are indeed severely compacted and might be causing you yield reduction is, I think, pretty valuable. On the flip side, we've estimated that farmers are spending upwards of $2 billion annually tilling soils that will not benefit from tillage. And that's because they're not currently compacted.
Wait, and so repeat being that able one more to, time. How much money are they spending?
Like $2 billion each year tilling soils that won't have any benefit from the tillage because the soils were not compacted to begin with.
Okay, $2 billion. So,
That seems like an easy place to start. Let's avoid tilling those soils. And so I think a lot of people are increasingly aware of the benefits of the benefits and soil health benefits and even carbon benefits of reduced soil disturbance. Every time you're moving the soil around, you're exposing microbes to the atmosphere that, you know, now can belch their CO2 and consume more organic material from your soil. So I think in general, everyone has consensus around the benefits of reducing soil disturbance. So that, you know, the Tillmapper product is awesome in terms of helping farmers save that no-brainer $2 billion that we ought to go reduce. That seems like a great place to start, but also allowing them to really focus whatever remaining tillage efforts they do have on the areas of their fields where it's going to have the biggest impact on their productivity. And actually, long-term, you know, productivity of agriculture is what produces carbon, right? So you're enhancing yields. It means you're enhancing future carbon sequestration. So it's not always a net evil thing in terms of all tillage is bad. We think, you know, smart tillage is good.
How does Tillmapper enable smart tillage? What does it really do at its core?
It shows you a map of where your compaction is and at what depth. And so that allows you, like I said, to avoid areas that won't benefit from tillage and focus your efforts on the areas that are most compact, but also even set your tillage implement to a depth where it's going to have the most impact. And so like you often get compaction layers in the soil, and you can think of like, if your job is to like break up a concrete sidewalk, you wouldn't want to dig like 2 feet under the sidewalk with an implement and then try to lift up and break it up. You'd want to get right underneath that concrete block and try to break it. Concrete sidewalk and try to break it up. And that's kind of how, you know, tillage with compaction layers work. You want to get the tillage implement right underneath the compaction layer, and it'll have the maximum impact in terms of breaking up that really hard compaction layer. And so having our depth maps actually allows tillage to be where it is happening to be a lot more effective in many cases.
So it sounds like what Tillmapper and Smart Tillage allows for is the farmer to till exactly where they need to, which saves them on fuel, labor, potential equipment issues. It maximizes their yield by ensuring that they're you know, not harming the soil health of anywhere where they don't need to. And then in general, it's just improving their soil health. Is that kind of the case? There's, you know, a multitude of benefits as a result of smart tillage.
Yeah, absolutely. That's, you know, that's exactly it.
That's amazing.
So I guess the next question, you kind of mentioned how, you know, all these things play together, right? Agronomy, the carbon space, tillage, they're interdependent on each other and one impacts the other. What do you think here at EarthOptics is the biggest opportunity for both farmers and ranchers to engage and interact in the carbon space?
Yeah, I think one of the most exciting ways and often overlooked ways is, I think we see it at EarthOptics, is we're just focused on the soil measurement side of it, is all these new carbon and sustainability programs are providing new dollars, not just for farmer programs, right, in terms of direct payments and incentives to farmers, but it's new dollars coming into the industry around measurement, right? And so like the way we view it at EarthOptics is, hey, we want to take these sustainability dollars that require verification of carbon in the soil and things like that, and that costs money. But we want to combine it with a comprehensive program of soil fertility, soil compaction, even soil biology, and carbon measurement that lowers the cost for the farmer around all those data products that they needed otherwise, like fertility. So I think it's an exciting time for on the carbon side for not just, you know, direct payments to farmers, but cost lowering on new data sets like EarthOptics can provide because there's new measurement dollars coming into the market. So, you know, we can often leverage those carbon programs to offer highly discounted fertility and compaction measurements because our technicians are already out there on the field. If I'm pulling soil to do a carbon test, I can, for not too much extra money, do a fertility test while we're at it. And so I'm really excited about that new opportunity for farmers to get all these great data sets at really a fraction of the cost that they would have had to, it would have gotten them without these programs.
And a one-stop shop, it sounds like. One-stop shop for yes. All of your, you know, soil mapping needs.
Absolutely.
It sounds like, you know, kind of summing everything up that we've talked about is, you know, data is incredibly powerful and incredibly valuable. And for far too long, farmers have not been collecting enough data that relates to their soil. And what Earth Optics provides is you know, high resolution maps and quantification of what's going on in their soil. And that data can really empower them in several ways, whether it be entering the carbon markets, whether it be streamlining their operations for fertility management or tillage. Is that the case here, that, you know, what is really starting to differentiate, you know, more successful operations than others is utilizing data?
No, that's absolutely. I think, especially when we started out, we, you know, spent a lot of time talking to farmers and ranchers, and we heard the same thing almost over and over again, as, you know, they get the amount of data that they can afford, not the amount of data that they actually want and or need. And so that's because, you know, soil testing is expensive. And so we wanted to make the level of data that you actually want or need as a farmer to optimize your decision-making. We wanted to make that affordable. And so I think increasingly we were making those two things match anymore. So now the amount of data you can get is right within that affordable level.
Awesome. And we've made it affordable by our methodology, which is, you know, like driving over with the sensors, which, you know, collects a lot more data. That's the case there, is that we've got a methodology that makes it affordable.
That's exactly it. Yeah. We can take a lot fewer soil samples, but you deliver a much higher resolution data product.
Lowering the cost of soil measurement and increasing the amount of data we're getting doesn't just mean you get more data and more resolution. It means you can measure more often too, if that's the route you want to go. So, I mean, maybe where you were getting data once every 3 years or 5 years, you could now maybe get it every year, every other year.
That's exactly it. It's you know, it's always been a compromise on both the resolution, like how dense you're going to sample and how frequently, right? So I think the most common is getting fertility testing done every 3 years, but that's not because you wouldn't want it every year. It's been not affordable, sufficiently affordable to get it every year. And so that's been one of our long-term goals, is how can we make soil measurement an annual and super affordable process?
That's awesome. Well, Lars, as we're kind of closing up here, you know, what, out of everything we've talked about today, what really excites you the most?
You know, to be honest with you, it's hard to pick. It's like saying which one of your children are your favorite. So I think, you know, each of the products and the things we do are one of my favorites. So I'll leave it at that. I'll give you the diplomatic answer.
There you go. You could be a politician too. You could add that to the resume.
A politician. Early in the call, Lars, you said soil is the answer to climate change. Am I quoting that correctly? And it sounds like, kind of as we wind down, that agriculture, you could almost fit that into the saying, agriculture is the answer to climate change.
Absolutely.
All right, Lars. Well, we appreciate you coming on and all your insight and wisdom into this space. We covered a broad range of topics today, and we'll be back soon with another episode. Stay grounded, and thanks for tuning in to Earth Optics.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Thank you.